There is a very specific kind of helplessness you feel when you're just standing on a curb, you're checking your wash, you're looking down an empty street, and you realize the bus is already 10 minutes late.
Oh, yeah, it's the worst.
It's not just annoyance, right? It feels like, I don't know, it feels like the city itself has broken a promise to you.
It really is the moment where the rubber of policy meets the road of reality. And usually the reality is losing.
Exactly. And today we aren't just complaining about late buses or, checking schedules on our phones. We are looking at the fundamental architectural flaw in how transit is actually planned.
The big one.
Yeah, the coverage versus frequency war. It is the choice between running a bus everywhere once an hour, so everyone technically has access, or running a bus in just a few places every 10 minutes so people can actually use it.
Right, this is the classic dilemma. Do you spread the butter thin so everyone gets a little bit, or do you pile it on where it counts? For decades, agencies have mostly just guessed at the answer. They've relied on intuition or political pressure. But today, we are looking at the hard data.
We really are, and we have a stack of research for this deep dive that is honestly a bit intimidating. We've got a massive study of 152 US regions. We've got hyperlocal data from Portland and Atlanta, and a really fascinating reality check from rural Norway.
We're also going to look at a legislative report from Washington State that basically uncovers a billion-dollar blind spot in how we even think about access.
Yeah, that part blew my mind. So the mission today is simple. We want to know if transit agencies actually control their own destiny or if they are just completely at the mercy of gas prices and the economy.
Let's unpack it.
Okay, we're starting with the heavy hitters. We have a study here by Lyons, Ewing, and Tian. And when I say massive, I really mean it. 152 regions across the US.
This study is significant because it tries to cut through all the usual noise. Usually, when ridership goes up, agencies love to pat themselves on the back.
Oh, sure. Look what a great job we did.
Exactly. But maybe gas prices just spiked, or the local economy boomed and more people are commuting. To figure out what actually works, the researchers use something called structural equation modeling, or SEM.
Okay, let's pause there for a second. I really don't want to get bogged down in the math formula, but why does some matter here? Like, why couldn't they just look at a spreadsheet of ridership numbers?
Because a raw spreadsheet lies to you. SEM allows the researchers to isolate the specific variables. Think of it like a mixing board in a recording studio.
Okay.
They can essentially mute the economy, mute the gas prices,
Yeah.
and just slide the faders on transit service to see what happens. They're looking for elasticity.
I love a good metric. How are we defining elasticity in this context?
Think of it as a lever. If I pull the service lever by 1%, meaning I add 1% more bus service out on the street, how much does ridership go up? If it goes up by 1%, that's a perfect one-to-one relationship.
So they compared two levers in this study. Lever A is route density, which is basically coverage, drawing more squiggly lines on the map to reach new neighborhoods.
Right.
And lever B is service frequency, how often the bus actually shows up. So who won?
Frequency was the clear winner. The study found that route density, the coverage lever, had an elasticity of about 0.691.
Okay.
But service frequency, that was 0.932.
Wow, 0.932. So for every 1% increase in frequency, you get almost a 1% increase in riders. That is practically a one-to-one return on investment.
Precisely. And the authors note that in the past, a lot of studies defined service provision way too vaguely. They just said, more service equals more riders. But the study proves that how you provide that service, specifically investing in time rather than space, matters immensely.
But wait, let's stop there because that sounds super efficient and the math looks very clean. But it also sounds pretty brutal.
It can be.
Because if I live in a quiet neighborhood that loses its only bus route just so that Main Street can have a bus every 5 minutes, I'm not going to care about the elasticity. I'm just stranded.
You have hit on the exact central tension of this whole field. The paper explicitly mentions this trade-off. It really is a zero-sum game.
Because the budgets are fixed.
Right. Most transit agencies do not have a magical pile of money. If they want to boost frequency to get that high ridership, they usually have to cut a route somewhere else to pay for it.
It feels like a choice between being a business that chases numbers and a public service that ensures equity.
That is the harsh reality of transit planning. You can chase ridership with frequency, or you can chase social coverage by ensuring every single neighborhood has a bus, even if it runs empty most of the day. The Lyons study suggests that if your primary goal is strictly getting people out of cars and onto buses, you have to choose frequency.
Okay, so the math heavily favors frequency. But do the actual human beings riding the bus agree? Because sometimes urban planners love efficiency a lot more than regular people do.
Very true.
We have a report here from Transit Center called Who's On Board? And they surveyed 3,000 riders across 17 different metros.
This is where we get into the amenities myth. You see this all the time. Agencies absolutely love to tout things like Wi-Fi on buses or power outlets at the seats.
Oh, yeah. They make for great press releases. I've seen those ads on the side of the bus, your mobile office, or ride in comfort.
But when you actually ask the riders to rank what improvements they want, those amenities are consistently at the bottom of the list.
Like dead last.
Near the very bottom. The winner, by an absolute landslide, is frequency, reliability, and travel time. Riders are effectively saying, I don't need to charge my phone, I just need to get to work on time.
Which makes total sense. If I'm stuck waiting 45 minutes for a bus in the pouring rain, having Wi-Fi at the stop doesn't make me any less angry.
Exactly. And the report actually debunks a very dangerous idea in transit planning. The myth of the captive rider.
What's that?
The idea is that low-income people, or people without cars, will ride the bus no matter how bad the service is, simply because they have to. So you don't really need to prioritize making the service competitive for them.
That sounds incredibly cynical. It's basically saying we don't need to treat you well because you have nowhere else to go.
It is deeply cynical, and the report says it's severely overstated. Even people without cars have limits. They will bum rides from friends, they will walk, or they simply won't make the trip if the service is terrible. Treating any group of riders as guaranteed is a surefire recipe for losing them.
The report highlights Houston as a major success story here, right? They essentially blew up their entire network and started over.
They did. Houston Metro completely redesigned their network. And the key is, they didn't just add a bunch of new money. They reallocated what they already had. They cut those low ridership, meandering coverage routes and poured all those resources into a high-frequency grid.
And what was the result?
Ridership went up 3 to 4% overall, and they saw double-digit increases on weekends. And you have to remember, this was at a time when national bus ridership was generally falling everywhere else.
That's really impressive. But there's another layer to the survey that caught my eye, the connection to walkability.
Yes. The survey found that 80% of all-purpose riders, meaning people who use transit for everything, not just commuting to an office walk to the bus.
So if you can't walk safely to the stop, the frequency doesn't even matter.
Correct. Transit improvements have to happen in walkable places. You can run a bus every 5 minutes, but if the stop is in a muddy ditch on the side of a busy highway, you aren't going to get riders. Keep that in mind because it is going to be crucial when we look at the Washington State report a little later.
Okay, so far the playbook seems pretty clear. Stop building wide, start building deep, frequency is king, build it and they will come. But we have another study here that throws a bit of a wrench in the gears. This is the Baribi, Joshi, and Watkins paper. And they basically say, not so fast.
This is the necessary plot twist of our deep dive. The first study we looked at, Lyons, was a cross-sectional study of those 152 regions. It looked at the big picture. And that tells you that in general, frequent systems have more riders.
Right.
But Baribi and his team went hyperlocal. They looked at stop-level data in Portland, Miami, Minneapolis, St. Paul, and Atlanta over a six-year period.
And they found something they call the cross-section trap. Can you explain that without us needing a PhD in statistics?
I can try. Think of it like squeezing a lemon. The Lyons study basically says, hey, lemons have juice. But Baribi asked, if I squeeze the exact same lemon harder, do I keep getting more juice?
And the answer is?
The answer was diminishing returns. When they looked at the changes within specific routes over time, that elasticity dropped. It wasn't 0.9 anymore. It fell to between 0.66 and 0.78.
Oh, wow. So if I double the frequency on a route, I don't actually get double the riders. You really are squeezing a dry lemon.
Exactly. They found that adding an extra bus to a route that is already decent might bring in fewer new riders than the bus before it. It contradicts this very popular idea that you can just infinitely dump buses onto a single route to get endless growth.
Why the difference, though? Why does it tap out?
It suggests that the high-frequency routes are already the workhorses because they serve the densest, most popular corridors in the city. They are productive because of where they are, not just because of how often they run. You can't necessarily replicate that success just by cranking up the dial on the schedule.
There was one exception, though. Minneapolis.
Yes, Minneapolis was the fascinating outlier here. Their high-frequency routes actually showed increasing elasticity.
Meaning the more buses they added, the faster ridership grew.
Right. And the authors speculate that maybe Minneapolis had historically invested so much in coverage, they were spread so thin for so long, that their frequent routes still had plenty of room to grow. They just hadn't hit the ceiling yet.
So context really matters. You can't just apply a blanket rule to every city. And speaking of context, let's totally flip the script. We've been talking about dense American cities and saturation. What about places where transit is barely even a blip on the radar? Let's go to Norway.
A fascinating shift. We are looking at a study by Roska and Said from the Agder region in Norway. Now, this isn't a metropolis. It is a network of small cities and towns. This is essentially hard mode for transit.
And the main problem there is the car. The study says 70% of travel is by car and only 5% by bus. Why is it so hard to get people on the bus in these small towns?
There are three big factors. First is parking. In Agder, free parking at work is completely standard. It was a massive deterrent to bus use, because if you can drive door to door and park for free, the bus is a really hard sell.
It's just the path of least resistance.
Exactly. The second factor is persons in care, which essentially means having kids. If you have to do the daycare drop off and pick up on the way to the office, taking the bus becomes logistically very difficult.
That makes total sense.
And third is car ownership. If a household has three or more cars, bus use drops to near zero.
But there was a finding in this study that I found totally counterintuitive. It was about the distance to work.
This is very surprising. Usually we think transit works best for short, quick trips. But in Agder, people who live farther away, over 45 kilometers, were actually more likely to take the bus than those living close by.
That feels entirely backward to me. If I have a super long commute, I want my car. I want control over my environment and my route.
Well, the expert analysis here suggests that for really long commutes, driving actually becomes a huge chore. It is tiring to be behind the wheel for that long. If the bus service is comfortable and reliable, people prefer to reclaim that time. They want to read a book, sleep, catch up on emails. But there is a catch.
The magic number.
Yes. The study identified a very strict frequency threshold. For the bus to be competitive on those long trips, it has to come every 20 minutes or better.
That's the breaking point.
It is. Once the frequency drops to every 30 or 60 minutes, ridership absolutely plummets. It does not matter how relaxing the ride is. If you have to wait an hour because you missed your bus by 2 minutes, you are taking the car tomorrow.
So even in these small, rural Norwegian towns, frequency is still the ultimate gatekeeper.
Absolutely.
Okay, so we've firmly established that frequency is crucial, but it's difficult to maximize without hitting diminishing returns, and it is constantly fighting a war against free parking and family logistics. Now, I want to talk about the actual cost of fixing all this. We have a report from the Washington State Department of Transportation, WSDOT, from June 2023.
This report brings us right back to the cold, hard reality of policy and budgets. WSDOT categorized the entire state's transit access into different levels.
Let's break those levels down for the listener. What is the gold standard?
Level one, that is a bus coming every 12 to 15 minutes, high frequency.
And what percentage of Washington state residents actually have access to level one service?
Only 7%.
7%, that is vanishingly small.
It really is. Yeah. Compare that to level six, which is defined as just two trips per day. Essentially a bare-bones lifeline service. About 63% of the state has that or better. But let's be honest, two trips a day is not a transportation system you can build a daily life around.
Right. If your doctor's appointment runs late, you're stuck until tomorrow. So the report lays out a scenario to improve this. They estimated the cost to move just 30% of the state population into that level one high-frequency access. What is the price tag on that?
To close that gap over a 15-year period, they estimated a funding gap of between $39 and $48 billion.
Billion with a B. That is a staggering amount of money just to get one-third of the state onto frequent transit.
It highlights why those trade-offs we discussed earlier with the Lyons study are so painful. Real-world expansion is incredibly expensive. But there is a detail in this WSDOT report that I think is honestly the most shocking part of our whole deep dive today. It's about the data gap.
Oh, I had to reread this part three times to make sure I wasn't misunderstanding it. You are telling me the Department of Transportation does not know where the sidewalks are.
It sounds absurd, doesn't it?
Yeah.
When WSDOT calculates who has access to transit, they look at who lives within a half-mile radius of a bus stop.
Right, which is a standard catchment area for walking.
But they have to calculate it as the crow flies, a straight-line radius on a map. Why? Because the state of Washington, and this is actually true for most states, does not have a comprehensive statewide data set of where the sidewalks actually are.
They just don't know where they are. They don't know if they're ADA accessible or if there is a crosswalk or a fence in the way.
So the report freely admits that their population estimates for transit access might be wildly inflated. You might live a quarter mile from a bus stop, as the crow flies, but if there is a six-lane highway with no crosswalk between your house and the stop,
you don't actually have access. You are totally stranded.
Exactly. You are statistically served by transit on a spreadsheet, but practically isolated in reality.
That connects right back to that transit center survey about walkability. We are potentially planning tens of billions of dollars in bus service without even knowing if people can physically walk to the bus safely.
It is a massive blind spot in the planning process. And the report also mentions they tried to analyze disparities by race and age to see if marginalized communities were being disproportionately underserved. But the results were essentially inconclusive.
Because of the data.
Partly because of the data gaps.
Hmm.
But also because demographic data moves much slower than reality. Gentrification can displace populations way faster than the census updates. So an agency might think they are serving a low-income community based on 2020 census data, but in 2023, that neighborhood has completely changed.
This feels like we've peeled back the onion and just found a lot more onion.
That is the nature of transit planning. It is complex systems layered on top of other complex systems.
So let's try to synthesize all this for the listener. We started with the core question. What actually drives ridership?
Well, the Lyons study and the Transit Center survey give us the headline. Frequency is the strongest lever. People want a bus that comes often, and they value that way more than Wi-Fi or plush seats.
But the Barabi study warns us not to get lazy with that logic. You can't just throw buses at a problem corridor and expect linear growth forever. There are real diminishing returns when you squeeze the lemon too hard.
And the Norway study reminds us that we are always fighting against the convenience of the personal car. If parking is free at the office and you have kids to haul around, the bus needs to be incredibly frequent, hitting that 20-minute threshold to even stand a chance of competing.
And finally, the WSDOT report throws cold water on our dreams by reminding us that frequent service costs tens of billions of dollars. And crucially, that we might be flying completely blind regarding the basic infrastructure of sidewalks.
It really emphasizes that transit doesn't exist in a vacuum. You can have the absolute best, most frequent bus schedule in the world. But if the city is built exclusively for cars, with free parking and no sidewalks, the bus is always going to struggle.
It seems like the coverage versus frequency debate is just the tip of the iceberg. The real debate is transit versus the built environment.
That is a very fair assessment. Sure. If we want ridership, we absolutely have to fund the frequency, but we also have to build the physical world that allows people to safely walk to that frequency.
So here is the final provocation I want to leave you with, listener. We talked about that WSDOT finding, the $48 billion gap to fund the buses, versus the total lack of data on sidewalks.
It raises a very uncomfortable question.
Yeah.
We are more than willing to debate spending billions on the vehicles, but we completely ignore the concrete beneath our own feet.
Exactly. We obsess over the schedule, but forget the journey to the stop. So next time you are out, I want you to look at your local bus stop. Don't just look at the schedule printed on the sign or check the app on your phone. Look at the street itself. Ask yourself, is this a coverage stop or a frequency stop? And more importantly, is this stop designed for a human being to actually reach it, or are you just a data point as the crow flies?
It really changes how you see the city around you.
It sure does. Thanks for riding along on this deep dive with us.
Safe travels out there.
See you next time.